Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Since the dawn of mankind, we have looked up into the heavens and wondered what was up there. We've mapped the stars, given them names, navigated by them, used them to tell the future, dreamed of flying among them. This hour, we'll talk about space. We'll talk about space exploration. We'll talk about stars and looking at them. Shuttle Atlantis touched down last week, ending a large chapter in the history of manned spaceflight. We'll talk about what's next for NASA and for American space exploration. We're also going to have a chat about what we can see this summer from right here in Wisconsin when we look up into the night sky. Joining me this morning is Richard Talcott, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine. He has written more than 100 feature articles on both the science of astronomy and observing the night sky. He also edits the popular Sky This Month section at the Center of Astronomy and creates most of the magazine's star charts. Richard Talcott, good morning and welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
So what is it about outer space that captures our imagination so much?
Well, I think for me and a lot of other people, it's the thrill of exploration, going where, to quote somebody from a long time ago, it's going where nobody's gone before. And I think that that's what drives the interest both in myself and among our readership, is the quest of doing something new that hasn't been done before, discovering things that have never been seen, and that kind of thing.
Finding the unknown, knowing the unknowable. I mean, we've done this, well, since day one. I mean, we looked up and we said, what's that? I guess humankind likes to have answers to things, don't we?
Sure, and it wasn't until, about 2,000 years ago that we started to get some answers, and then about 400 years ago or so when Galileo first turned his first telescope to the sky is when we really started to understand a lot of the things that are out there that were really beyond the realm of anything that you could see with your naked eyes.
Well, we look back now and we kind of laugh at some of the early assumptions that human beings made about what was in the heavens, but I suspect that, you know, if humans are still around 500 or 1,000 years from now, they may look back and laugh at us as well.
I'm sure that's the case. We certainly look back on what the scientists, or quote-unquote scientists, of a couple thousand years ago thought about a lot of things, and they thought that the sun and the other planets moved around Earth and in very complicated paths that had motions and circles within circles. And obviously that is not true, and we've learned much better than that over the succeeding years. But, you know, I think in the broad general sense of how the world is put together, scientists have a pretty good idea now. I mean, we know that the Earth and the planets move around the sun, and we know that galaxies exist and stretch throughout the universe. So I think in a broad general sense, we know what's out there. But there's always going to be some surprises. Even just about 10 years ago now, we discovered that about two-thirds to three-quarters of the universe was something that we never even knew existed, which was something called dark energy, which is causing the universe to expand even faster than it used to, which goes totally against what people would have thought in terms of gravity slowing things down as it expands, but it's actually speeding up right now. So we can even find things like that that nobody had any inkling of up until just about the turn of the century.
Well, it's interesting. Yesterday, Brian Cox was on with us talking about his new book, Wonders of the Universe. And, you know, we were talking about some of the same things and how, you know, we're learning so much and there's so much we don't know yet and so much left to discover. And that's actually very exciting, that there's probably more that we don't know than we actually do know, but we're finding new things every day.
That's certainly true. And that's been the case, I think, all along, is that the more that we learn, the more we realize we don't know. And the things that each new space mission brings to the knowledge that we have is that there's a lot more questions that we have that we didn't even realize we should have been asking before.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's kind of where I was heading. I wanted to kind of put a floor under this topic of space exploration. The space shuttle program, of course, ended last week when Atlantis touched down. Looking back now on somewhat 150 plus space shuttle missions. Was the shuttle program a success? Did it achieve the goals that NASA had set for it?
I think the rosiest pictures that NASA and a lot of other people had for it back in the 1970s when it was being dreamed up, I think it's safe to say that it didn't come all that close to reaching that. The original plan was that it would be a very cheap and easy way to get into space and deliver things into Earth orbit, and it didn't turn out that way because it ended up being a lot more expensive, largely because it was new technology that was being used, and then there were also the two shuttle disasters that obviously made us take a look at what was going on and slowing the pace down. So we never got the cheap, easy access to orbit that we wanted to, but probably the main mission that it had was to help build the International Space Station, and that's pretty much finalized right now. So that was a success for the space shuttle mission. And for us people that like astronomy, I think the key thing that it did that would have been impossible otherwise is to service the Hubble Space Telescope, which it went to five different times, and allowed us really to get a very good look at what's going on in the universe that wouldn't have been possible if the shuttle hadn't been able to go up there and astronauts work on fixing it.
Well, I want to come back to the Hubble Space Telescope, but first, how does the shuttle program stack up against other signature programs for NASA like Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo?
I would say that it allowed us to get into orbit fairly, and it may go against what I was just saying about cheap and easy, but it was at least cheaper and easier than it was in the days of Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. And so it did allow us to go up there and do some things that we wouldn't have been able to do, presumably, if we had been using the non-reusable rockets that we did back in the 1960s and early 1970s. So in that sense, I think the shuttle did a lot of good. But I think everything leading up to the moon landings in the late 60s and early 70s that Mercury and Gemini led up to, I think that in terms of the thrill of exploration was far beyond what the shuttle was able to accomplish, because it was more routine access to space as opposed to having this broad and glorious goal of getting to the moon.
I was a child of the 60s.
I know the feeling.
I was in elementary and junior high and high school. There were actual space science classes in the schools. There was a real emphasis on outer space in science programs. And we were all really excited about space. We were excited about looking at the stars. We were excited about astronauts and going to the moon. And after that, you know, it was going to be Mars was next and all this. On television, we had science fiction was big in the 60s. All of a sudden, we get to the moon, and we go there a few times. And the next thing you know, nobody's paying attention. What happened? I mean, did we lose something at some point here so that space didn't seem as romantic? Did it get too routine? I think that's the word you used a moment ago. But somewhere in there, NASA kind of lost its luster, and almost seems like we didn't give up on space exploration, but it certainly started to take a real backseat to other stuff.
And I think that's true, and in a large part, I think it's President Kennedy's. We should laud President Kennedy as well as bring him down a little bit. I think the lauding goes to his goal of sending man to the moon by the end of the 1960s, and we accomplished that. But I think in the public mind, the space program became something simply the goal was to get to the moon. And once that goal was reached, there wasn't anything to go beyond that. And so we ended up with programs that were, at least as far as human exploration of space was concerned, is that we did what we wanted to, and now there's not anything left in terms of goals for humans. And as you mentioned, there was talk about going to Mars, but going to Mars is a lot more difficult than the moon and required technology that really wasn't going to be available shortly after the Apollo mission. And so there wasn't anything that you could immediately go to right after Apollo that would get us out further into the solar system. And so I think that was part of the problem, is that we met our goals that we had set for ourselves. And after you've done that, interest is bound to lag.
So what's next for NASA? The shuttle program is done. What's the next? What's NASA's plan for their next major project?
Well, that's always a good question, because the politics of Washington always seem to be moving goalposts in terms of what NASA tries to do. For a long time, there was the plan of what's called Constellation, which was going to take us back to the moon, presumably by 2020. And from there, we would be able to launch missions to some of the closer asteroids. And asteroids are rocky bodies that mostly reside between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, and are actually somewhat easier to reach than Mars would be. And so that was one of the ideas, was to go to asteroids and also build up to going to Mars eventually, perhaps by, say, 2030 or so, just to give a rough idea. But the most recent budget proposed by the president got rid of the Constellation program, which was already I wouldn't say well underway, but at least fairly far along, and replace it with something called the Space Launch System, which would be a way of getting, again, more into low Earth orbit, which is where the shuttle has been going. And so right now, I would say NASA's mission is not all that well defined in terms of where human exploration is going, because they've got budget problems, as everybody does in Washington now, and the exact goal of these new transportation systems are not super well thought out and definitive.
So as of right now, we don't have any way to service the International Space Station. The only way that we have of getting humans up there is to go to Russia first and go up on a Soyuz capsule. I understand it's going to be at least 5 years before we have our own vehicle that could put humans back into space.
Yeah, that looks like the time frame that seems most reasonable. It's about 5 years from now before there's something available that will be able to take us up into orbit and go to the space station.
There's been a debate for some time about over manned versus unmanned space exploration. What are your thoughts on this? Does each have its place, or do you think one's better than the other? What do you think?
I think each has their place as far as expanding our horizons and figuring out what it is that's out there in the universe. I think unmanned exploration is probably the best way to go, and certainly the least expensive way to go. NASA has several missions that are underway right now that are out exploring different planets in the solar system, or will soon be on their way to explore planets in the solar system, something that humans are far away from being able to do. And as I mentioned, Mars is the next goal for human exploration in terms of planets. But that's still, I would say, at least 20 years off. And I remember back in the 1970s, we were saying it might be 20 years off, too. So saying 20 years now may be about as realistic as saying 20 years in the 1970s. The Hubble Space Telescope and its successor, the James Webb Space Telescope, are both things that can expand our knowledge of the universe much better than humans can, because they can peer out into the distant universe and see things as they were when the universe was much younger. And so they give us a much better idea of kind of the grand things that are happening out in space that humans are not going to be able to get to. Not only just in the foreseeable future, but perhaps forever, things like going to other stars and to distant galaxies.
I want we need to take a break, but I want to, when we come back, I want to talk about that Webb telescope, because I'd like to hear more details on what that is all about.
Sure.
And what future there is, if any, for the Hubble Space Telescope. We're talking about outer space today and the stars and exploration and looking at the heavens and finding out what's out there, with Richard Talcott, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine, and wondering if you have some questions about space and about exploration, about the stars. We are going to have, we will segue into a conversation during this hour where we talk about how we can make our own observations of what's happening in outer space. And Richard Talcott has some advice for us there, what we should be looking for in the skies over Wisconsin as we approach the end of July. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 22 minutes after 9 o'clock, here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network. As the role of technology expands for children from K through 4 through high school, is the practice of teaching cursive writing in elementary school becoming outdated? After 5, join Ben Marins and his guests in a discussion about cursive writing and how it stimulates brain activity in children. This hour, we're talking about space and observing the heavens and why we do it and what's so fascinating about it and what's happening next in space exploration with NASA and so forth. My guest is Richard Talcott, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine. The Webb Telescope, now, is that a replacement for the Hubble, and do we expect the Hubble to just stop working? What's going to happen there?
Well, with the shuttle no longer working, and so there's no way that astronauts can go up and repair it anymore, they'll eventually come a time when it basically stops working, as almost every machine does. It wears down over time, and as we've seen in the past with Hubble, it ends up getting problems usually after 3, 4, or 5 years since astronauts last visited it. And so that's going to happen with Hubble again, is that eventually it's going to get to the stage where it's not able to control where it points in the sky. And that's the thing that really allows it to take long, deep looks into the universe, is being able to stay rigidly pointed at the same spot. And that will probably be another 3, 4, or 5 years before it starts to get to the stage where NASA won't be able to control its pointing very well anymore. And at that stage, it will pretty much be end of mission. And what NASA will plan to do then is to bring it back to Earth, unfortunately not inside the shuttle cargo bay, but they'll bring it back down, and most of it will burn up in the atmosphere and eventually fall into the Pacific Ocean. So that's what Hubble's future looks like, and the goal of NASA is that at about the same time, and with a little bit of luck, a little bit earlier than that, they'll be able to launch the James Webb Space Telescope to basically replace what Hubble does. Now, there are a couple of differences between it. One is that the Hubble Space Telescope looks mostly invisible light, the kind of things that we see with our own two eyes, whereas the James Webb Space Telescope is going to be looking more into what's called infrared radiation, which is a little bit longer wavelengths than visible light. And the reason this is worthwhile is because a lot of the radiation in space is in this form. And also, the farther you look into the universe, the redder the light tends to be. And so if you want to look toward the very distant universe and see where the first galaxies and first stars formed, which is one of the main missions of the Webb Space Telescope, you really have to look into the infrared part of the spectrum. And so Webb is going to be able to do much better in terms of looking into the far distant universe. And it also is a much larger mirror. The Hubble Space Telescope's mirror is about 8 feet across, whereas the Webb Space Telescope is closer to 22 feet. And so it's going to be able to gather a lot more light, and the light it does gather, it will gather much more quickly. And so it'll be a much higher science return for our dollar than the Hubble Space Telescope even can give us.
And how are we getting that into outer space?
That'll be on a expendable rocket. So it's going to go up the way most of the missions to the planets that NASA has launched recently have gone. In other words, they just basically start with a rocket either in Kennedy Space Center in Florida or out in California. They launch up, and instead of going into orbit around Earth, they just keep going. They move fast enough to get beyond Earth's atmosphere.
The shuttle got the headlines last week, but we've been getting some pretty dramatic pictures of the giant asteroid Vesta. It's pretty interesting stuff. Talk about the program that allowed us to get these pictures and why they're significant.
Yeah, this is the Dawn spacecraft, and it arrived at the asteroid Vesta just about the same time the shuttle was going up last. On July 16th, it entered orbit around Vesta, and people may not be familiar with Vesta, but it's the second largest asteroid in the solar system. It's approximately 300 miles or so across, which is a pretty hefty-sized rock, a lot smaller than the planets are, but still very large relative to most of the things in the solar system. And what NASA did is they used a fairly new type of propulsion called ion propulsion, which sounds like something out of Star Trek, but it's actually been used a couple of times before. And what this allows is for NASA to send spacecraft to objects at a very leisurely pace, but the nice thing is that when it gets to the object, it's traveling at about the same speed as the object, and so it's very easy to go into orbit around it, whereas a lot of the other missions that it sends out to the planets, you basically have to fire lots of rocket power in order to slow the object down to be captured into orbit, and carrying a lot of fuel with you is just basically very cost prohibitive because you have to build a bigger rocket to carry the more fuel. And so ion propulsion allows spacecraft to get out into the solar system for a relatively inexpensive and low weight, which is very nice. Basically, Vesta is what's left over from planets trying to form between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Scientists think that way back at the beginning of the solar system, about 4.5 billion years ago, there were lots of small objects that basically collided with each other and basically grew larger and larger over time. So that's how we got the planets, particularly the inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, formed in this way by just collisions and then growing through those collisions. But out beyond the orbit of Mars and before Jupiter, Jupiter is so large that its gravity kind of stirred up the region there, and all these small objects weren't able to coalesce into one or two bigger objects. And so what we have there are the leftovers of the building blocks of our solar system. And that's why NASA is interested in going to Vesta and later on to the largest of these asteroids, which is called Ceres. This same mission will be going to Ceres starting late next year. It's going to be taking a look at these objects, trying to see what the differences are, is trying to see what the building blocks of our solar system are like. And they presumably have not changed very much since the first few million years after the solar system was born, unlike Earth, Mars, and the other planets, which have undergone lots of changes since the formation.
So if we can really explore those, we can get some hints about our own planetary history.
Yeah, one scientist mentioned this, and I thought it was a good analogy, is that exploring these different kinds of objects is like building up a jigsaw puzzle of the solar system. And to really understand the entire solar system, you have to put in all these different pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. And certainly the asteroids and these primitive objects that are out here and where there are lots of other asteroids is one of the key missing pieces right now in the jigsaw puzzle, and it's hard to know exactly what we're missing in the overall picture until we actually go to these asteroids and try to figure out what they're like precisely and how they fit into the formation of the solar system.
I realized just a moment ago that I had neglected one of the first duties of a talk show host, and that was to give the call-in number. Here it is, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. You can also leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook fan page, and we'll translate that into audio. So three ways to get in touch with the program and ask your questions or make a comment for Richard Talcott as we talk about space and space exploration and just kind of, you know, what's out there. How did you first get interested in astronomy?
Well, it was kind of like what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. For me, it was the space missions back in the 1960s. I was born in the 1950s, and so I was just at that age where interest in what was going on outside of our solar system and the quest for going to the moon was really big, and that really fired my imagination. And the second thing I think that got me interested was a bright comet that occurred back in the mid-1960s. It was called Ikea Seki, named after the two Japanese astronomers who discovered it. It was the brightest comet of the last 100 years or so, and I saw that in the morning sky back in the mid-1960s and was really impressed by what it looked like, and that got me interested in the study of what's out in space, as well as what objects are out there and what they can tell us about the universe.
What did the first time you got a look into a telescope and really got to see the what was in the sky, not necessarily close up, but certainly closer than with the naked eye, how did you feel about that? How exciting was that?
Well, that was a really big thrill, and I think almost everyone that's looked through a telescope, the biggest thrill comes when you see Saturn, because it turns out that unless you have a lot of experience, most of the objects that you see through a telescope are not the way that they look in pictures that you see in magazines or in books. And for some people, that gets a little bit disappointing because they expect to see these big, bright, bold colors, which you don't really see in most of the objects that you can see through a typical backyard telescope. But Saturn looks picture perfect through almost any size telescope. You can see the rings around Saturn in quite a bit of detail circling the planet itself, and it really stands out as something that looks almost precisely like what you would have expected it to do. And to actually see something like that through the eyepiece is a real thrill. And probably secondarily, I would say the moon, and perhaps again that goes back to the quest of the 1960s to go explore the moon, but you can see a lot through a telescope, that just incredible detail that you can't see with your naked eyes. And so being able to explore the moon's surface and the craters on there is really a thrill as well.
Well, let's take some phone calls. We have a bunch of people who would like to get in on the conversation. We'll start out in San Francisco. David. David, good morning.
Hey, morning. You know, I've been interested in international law for a long time, and looking at what happened probably 1,000 years ago, at least 500 years ago with Christopher Columbus, the international law in the oceans was a big deal, and now international law in outer space is going to be an even bigger deal. It was one thing where somebody could go off and get wrecked on a shore and have problems, but now when you haul something into outer space and it has the opportunity to just randomly fall anywhere onto the Earth, what are the liability laws of outer space? In other words, if somebody shot a rocket into the sky and it was a bad orbit and it fell down onto a city somewhere, you know, destroying a bunch of people's lives, have there been laws developed to look at the liability of things like that? Are organizations and nations bonded so that they have a reserve on hand in case a thing like that happens?
Excellent question. I would say that in terms of what goes on here on Earth in low Earth orbit, excuse me. So in other words, you've got the rockets going up, and occasionally they come back down when we don't want them to. That is something that the country that is the one that's sending up the rocket is essentially liable for. So it basically goes the way that you would have thought, is that the country involved in creating the problem is the one who has the liability there. At first, I thought you were going to talk about international law and who gets to claim objects that spacecraft go to. So in other words, does the United States have rights over the moon because we've been the only country to go there? And the answer to that is no. The United Nations basically has come up with laws that the nations have agreed to, that the moon is a place for all humankind, to quote the plaque left behind by Apollo 11, is something that has been already litigated, so to speak, in the sense that the moon is for all humans and not just for one country. So we don't hold any claim over the lunar territory.
David, thanks for the call. What are some of the features of the night sky in the summer that you can't see at other times of the year?
Well, probably the main thing that doesn't happen at other times of the year is the Perseid meteor shower, and that's probably the year's best meteor shower typically. And what meteors are little bits of dust that burn up in Earth's atmosphere as Earth runs into them, and they have streaks of light in the sky. For the Perseid meteor shower, you can sometimes see up to about 100 meteors per hour, which is a pretty impressive number. This year, unfortunately, the moon is going to be full at the same time as the Perseid shower is, and that peaks on August 12th and August 13th. And so the show won't be quite as good as it is some years, probably only about 20 to 25 meteors per hour if you're out under a dark sky. So that's probably the main thing that you see in summertime that you don't necessarily see at other times of the year. But there are a couple of other pretty cool things that are in the sky right now. One of them is the planet Saturn. And it lies about a third of the way from the horizon up to straight overhead in the early evening sky in the southwest. And it's the brightest object over in that general area of the sky. So that's something that people can see very easily. And even more impressive is the planet Jupiter, which is up well before dawn. So if you happen to be out before the sun rises and take a look in the eastern sky before the sun comes up, you'll see a very bright point of light. And that's the planet Jupiter.
And you can see these, you can see the morning and evening stars. You can see with the naked eye, so that's always kind of cool. You don't need necessarily any special equipment to do stargazing, do you?
No, not at all. And even binoculars will allow you to see a lot more than just your naked eyes. So if you have a pair of binoculars you use for bird watching or other pursuits on the ground, you can turn those to the sky. One thing that a lot of people are surprised about is that if you hold your binoculars steady or mount them on a tripod, you can actually see four moons circling Jupiter. And that's something that a lot of people are unaware of, and it's certainly kind of a neat little thrill to see these objects moving around Jupiter from one night to the next.
Let's take a call from Earl in Medford next. Hi, Earl. Good morning.
Good morning, and congratulations on a great magazine, Richard.
Thank you.
Enjoy every issue. I wanted to speak up in favor of the robotic missions, especially Voyager. I've been fascinated with Voyager now over 30 years, and it barely got off as part of the grand tour where they were going to have one space program get to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And also the Mars rovers that went well beyond their expected time and returned lots of good science, just like Voyager still is.
Yeah, those are very great programs. Voyager is probably the best mission to the planets that NASA or anyone else has ever run. As you mentioned, it went past Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. It wasn't the first spacecraft to Jupiter and Saturn, but it was to Uranus and Neptune. And the technology that was used was much better than any previous mission to Jupiter and Saturn. So we learned a great deal about the four big outer planets in our solar system. And I think that's probably the key one. The final planet in the solar system, depending on your point of view and who you like to believe, is Pluto. And NASA actually has a mission that's on its way to Pluto right now that should be there in the next few years. And so we'll get our first look at this dim dwarf planet, as scientists now tend to call it, near the outer edge of the solar system.
Earl, thanks a lot for that call. We're going to have more calls and more questions for Richard Talcott, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine, about astronomy and outer space and space exploration. All of those things are within the scope of questions and answers for this hour. We have some lines available if you'd like to call right now, I think. And if not, if you get a busy signal, just send us an email, talk@WPR.org. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 941, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next hour, my guest and I discuss the importance and meaning of questions when we talk about the new book titled, What? Are these the 20 most important questions in human history, or is this a game of 20 questions? It should be fun. That's coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we have our space on our minds, stars and planets and moons and asteroids, and exploring them and looking at them and why they're so fascinating to us. And my guest is Richard Talcott, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine. 800-486-8655 is the number to call to join the program. We'll go next to Green Bay and hear from Mark. Mark, good morning.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity. There was an article in Science News a couple of weeks ago that there are billions of planets in the galaxy that got kicked off from their parent star and are kind of rogue entities wandering through the galaxy. And there's another article that talked about Mercury having abnormally high levels of sodium and potassium on its surface, which should have been volatilized a long time ago. So I'm wondering, what's the criteria to figure out if a planet has been captured or if it formed in the same nebula as the Sun?
Good question, and you're right about the two studies that came out recently that talk about that. We've talked about NASA a lot and about its missions to the planets, and one thing that we hadn't talked about yet is that there's a mission orbiting Mercury right now called MESSENGER, and it's been exploring Mercury for the last 3 to 4 months and returning a lot of great data about it. And one of the things that it found is that there's a lot more, there are more elements on there that would tend to be boiled off if it formed in the inner solar system where it is right now. And so the question is, did it form elsewhere? And presumably by elsewhere, we mean further out in the solar system and then kind of migrated inward. And that's probably the leading guess right now as to what's happened to Mercury, is that it formed further out, so it was able to hold on to these different elements and then moved kind of inward from there. And interestingly enough, in just the last 15 years or so, astronomers have started to discover lots of planets orbiting other stars in our galaxy. And a lot of these worlds are very close to their stars. And this is what led them to think about planets migrating from more distant orbits, kind of equivalent to where Jupiter and Saturn are, in very close to their stars. It seems to have happened a lot in other solar systems, and so perhaps the same kind of thing has happened here, and that's why Mercury is so close but appears to perhaps have formed a bit further out. The rogue planets is very interesting, and when you say that there's might be a billion such planets out there that are unattached to stars, that's based on a fairly small sample and just extrapolating it out to how many, if you take a certain number in a certain region of sky and extrapolate it to the whole galaxy, you get up to the numbers of billions. And that could well be the case. It is kind of interesting. There are most of the stars in our galaxy, and by most I mean more than 50%, are actually parts of binary systems. And so there are two stars orbiting one another, and in some case more than two stars orbiting one another. Presumably the interactions between those stars can end up throwing planets out of orbit from those stars. And there's a lot of interesting celestial mechanics that can explain how planets both can stay in orbit around a double star and how they might get flung out from close passes of those two stars or of other star systems. And so that's presumably where a lot of these planets that are roaming around formed. In other words, they formed around stars but then were kicked out later on.
Mark, thanks for the call. Let's go to Schofield next and talk to John. John, good morning.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. I know that you talked about the Hubble a while back, and I know when it first was sent up, it wasn't functioning right. And I wonder if you could just talk about what was done to repair it and some of the problems they might have had, other than, of course, they're doing it in space, and really what was involved. And one other quick question. I know where the name came for the Hubble, but where did the name come for the Webb telescope? And I'll listen off the air. Thanks a lot.
Sure. The problem back in shortly after Hubble was launched back in 1990, astronomers discovered that it wasn't focusing light properly. And that was kind of a shock to astronomers and a disappointment to everyone at NASA. It turns out that the Hubble Space Telescope mirror was the most finely polished mirror in the history of humankind, but it wasn't polished to the exact right figure. And that's kind of a somewhat technical term, but the rays of light that were bouncing off the mirror didn't come to the same focus, and so it was kind of like having two eyes that would not focus the same way, and you ended up with blurry images. That was the genius, I think, of NASA's plan to have the Hubble telescope be able to be serviced by astronauts. And what they basically did was they went up there and they put what are glorified eyeglasses on the Hubble Space Telescope. So the light from the main mirror may not go exactly where scientists wanted it originally, but by putting on eyeglasses, you basically restored the telescope to what was the original plan. And that's what they did in their first servicing mission back in the early 1990s. It restored Hubble to everything that astronomers expected from it from the very start. As to the second part of your question, who James Webb was, you're right. Edwin Hubble, who the Hubble Space Telescope was named after probably the greatest observational cosmologist in history, the one that discovered that the galaxies are moving away from Earth and also that there are other galaxies beyond our own. That was something that was unknown until the 1920s, and he was the one that discovered both of those things. James Webb is a little bit more prosaic explanation. He was a former NASA administrator. And the reason that they've named this next generation telescope after him is because he was the one that led the manned space program in the 1960s that led us to the moon. And he also was the one that, unlike some people at the time, said that NASA should have a balanced approach. It should explore science as well as just doing the manned moon landings. And so he was really the driving force behind NASA being more than just sending humans into space. It was also a research machine for figuring out other things about the solar system and the universe beyond.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to Janesville next. And Seth, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hey, my question was, what do you think is the future of spaceflight commercially now that NASA has ended its shuttle program? They mentioned they're going to be sort of turning it over to commercial private enterprises. What do you think is going to happen?
I have every confidence that the commercial companies are going to be able to reach access to Earth orbit. I think it's going to take NASA and another large program to send people beyond Earth, either back to the moon, to an asteroid, or to Mars again. I don't think there's any way commercial companies are going to be able to come up with the money, although I'm not sure necessarily that the United States will be able to come up with the money either. But I think it's going to take some large government or international program to be able to send us beyond Earth orbit. But commercial companies have already started to do a pretty good job of building the rockets that are needed to get cargo as well as humans into low Earth orbit. And they haven't actually sent humans up to the space station yet, but that's one of the goals, is that eventually these commercial companies will be able to take over and actually send people with the requisite amount of money, which is probably more than most of us have, up into orbit and into space.
Seth, thanks for that. That reminds me, I wanted to ask, do you think we'll ever see anything like the kind of shuttles that Stanley Kubrick imagined in his film 2001. Well, Arthur C. Clarke wrote it, but are we going to see, that was Pan Am, which no longer exists, but do you think we're ever going to see that kind of manned space travel at some point?
Well, my gut tells me yes, but my gut also tells me it's not going to be in the next decade or two. It's probably going to be, I think space is going to be a hostile environment for such things for probably another half century anyway. And perhaps by that point, we'll be able to get to the stage where we're zipping around almost like we do on airplanes right now. But I think that's still a long ways off.
Jeff in Milwaukee, let's take your call next. Jeff, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Can you talk about Titan, the moon of Saturn, and including what happened in 1986, I think it was, with a flyby that malfunctioned?
Not quite sure about the flyby that malfunctioned, but I can certainly talk about Titan. Titan is the second largest moon in the solar system and one that goes around the planet Saturn. And the interesting thing about it is that it has a very thick atmosphere, very similar to Earth's. Earth's atmosphere is made up of approximately 70 to 75% nitrogen, and it turns out that the atmosphere around Titan is almost exactly the same nitrogen-rich kind of atmosphere. I shouldn't say exactly the same because it doesn't have oxygen like Earth's atmosphere does, but it is nitrogen-dominated, which is very unusual in the planets in the solar system to have a nitrogen-rich atmosphere. So it does have that. It also appears to have lakes on its surface, and you might wonder how you'd get lakes on a planet that's basically 10 times farther from the sun than Earth is. And it turns out that the lakes are not made out of water, but they're made out of methane. And there's some methane gas in the atmosphere, and it precipitates out onto the ground as rain, and it forms into lakes that wax and wane with the seasons on Titan. So it's a very interesting place. It resembles Earth in many ways, except it's far colder. The temperature there is a few hundred degrees below zero, and so it's not habitable in the same sense that Earth is, but it does have some of the same characteristics that it does. And the kind of indications that something interesting was going on with Titan came back as early as the 1960s when astronomers realized it had an atmosphere, which is unusual for any moon in the solar system, actually, and then was followed on by the Voyager spacecraft that we talked about a little bit earlier in this hour that flew past in the 1980s and returned images of this hazy world. And the current spacecraft that's out there at Saturn now, which is called Cassini, and that's been orbiting Saturn for the past several years now, and it's been returning images and taking radar measurements of the surface of Titan, as well as looking at all the Saturn's other moons and the planet itself.
Thanks a lot for that call. Kenny in Duluth, you're next. Good morning, Kenny.
Good morning. I was just really interested in, like, the Kepler space program, discovering other planetary systems around stars, and I'm a biology student. I'm going to graduate this spring, and I was just wondering what role biologists play in, like, planetary exploration right now and in the future, and if I could, you know, do something with my biology degree with that.
Sure, there's always room for people that have interdisciplinary interests, and biology is one of the key things that astronomers are looking for, is kind of this cross-melding of different disciplines. Astrobiology is very important right now because one thing scientists are trying to do is to figure out what kind of conditions may exist on other worlds that would lead to life either as we know it or some other kind of life that maybe not as we know it. And the Kepler spacecraft you mentioned was launched about a year or two ago, and basically it's been staring at one spot in the sky looking for planets, and it's already discovered several hundred planets, and over the next few years we'll probably be ones to discover the first Earth-like planets, or at least ones that have about the same size and distance from their star as Earth is from the sun. And these are the kinds of planets that astronomers are really interested in taking a closer look at as being possible analogs to Earth, and perhaps some of them might even have conditions where life could arise. In other words, be living where water is available to create the chemical reactions that presumably led to life early on in our history, and perhaps and likely do happen around other stars as well.
Kenny, good luck. One more call, I think. Bob in Appleton. Bob, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I tuned in a little late. I may have missed something, but it struck me as odd. Why do we feel compelled to go to Mars when we haven't been on the moon for a long time? And why don't we just go to the moon, build a city, build a research facility, build all the infrastructure that you could build on the moon, and then take it from there? Why the exotic
question.
Race
and,
to Mars,
and in fact,
strikes me as pointless?
It's a good question, and I think one that NASA struggled with as well. The Constellation program that I talked about, which was canceled about a year or so ago, that was the goal of it. It was first to return to the moon, build habitats there where humans could stay on the surface of the moon for extended periods, exploit some of its resources there, and not necessarily build cities, but build habitats where humans could stay for quite a period of time. And then from there, once you've built up that kind of knowledge of how to live on another world for extended periods, you could start to think about going to Mars from the moon as opposed to directly from Earth here. That program's kind of fallen by the wayside, and partially it may be one of those vision kinds of things where people say, we've been to the moon already, that's not going to excite the next generation of astronauts and astronomers and scientists in general. We need a new goal that's a little bit flashier, and Mars is probably the flashiest thing out there that humans could go to, and I think that's the reason why the focus has shifted more from moon onto Mars.
We only have about a minute left in the program. Richard Talcott, a quick, maybe a couple of quick tips on how to get started in astronomy. Do you have to go out to the country? Can you do it from in town?
There's a lot of great things that you can see from in the city, usually the brightest stars and the planets. But as I mentioned, Jupiter is the brightest point of light in the sky, and the moon is up more often than it isn't and is always something that can be seen with the naked eye or binoculars very nicely. So those are the kinds of things that you can do from the city very easily. And from the suburbs, you can do a lot more because it's not quite as bad as in the city. Being out in the country lets you see a lot more stars and allows you to do a lot more, but it's certainly not a necessary thing to be able to get interested in observing the sky.
Okay, well, I really appreciate your time this morning. A fascinating hour. I'd love to talk to you about this stuff again.
Sure, I'd be very happy to.
Richard Talcott, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine, and he's written more than 100 feature articles on both the science of astronomy and observing the night sky. He joined us by phone this morning. We, Rhonda Fanning produced this hour of programming. Chrissy Pease handled on-air production. If you would like to listen to it again, if you got in late and missed part of the conversation, you can always go to our website, WPR.org, and look at and listen to it all over again, WPR.org. Just go to the Kathleen Dunn program notes section and you'll be able to see the link to the recording. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Stick around. We're going to have an entire hour full of questions coming up next.